From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Papua New Guinea's struggle to contain sorcery-related violence is being linked to the lack of development for the majority rural population. In recent days, more reports have emerged from the highlands of attacks on people accused of using so-called sorcery. While PNG scrapped the Sorcery Act 3 years ago in a move to criminalize such acts, it's proving hard to change mindsets. Johnny Blades reports.
Reports have emerged from Jiwaka province of a Lutheran pastor's assistant being buried alive for allegedly using sorcery. Koip village, where this took place 2 weeks ago in Middle Jimmy district, is very remote, according to the district administrator, Matthew Kuraiwai.
Geographically, it's very difficult. Jimmy is very remote, and some of the villages you cannot reach by vehicles or even planes and into the area. It's just by walking. It's very difficult for us to cover so many things at one time with the financial situations that the government is going through.
Shortly after the attack, a Highlands-based maternal health and education activist, Ruth Kissam, visited the village. She learnt that the perpetrator has been cutting off hands of elderly people and terrorising the community. The chronically under-resourced provincial police force is barely able to reach the village and needs community help to bring in the suspect. Ms Kissam says in some parts of the Highlands, police have begun to take out orders against village councillors.
Anyone that starts off a fight in the village or rape or kill, they take in the councillor or the magistrate and they say 6 months in jail if you don't give up the men. So then the pressure mounts on the person to hand himself in, and they do that. So if the community and the police can work together to have some form of understanding between them, then they will be able to bring peace into the community and have the suspect arrested.
Churches have been working to change people's minds about sorcery, but the head of PNG's Evangelical Lutheran Church says sorcery-related killings seem to be worsening. Bishop Jack Urame says areas where these attacks tend to take place usually lack basic infrastructure, health and education facilities.
A lot of people are accused because think their life pattern is changing, the social pressure, you know, and lack of development, and the lifestyle disease is increasing, and people are, you know, dying all of a sudden, and so people continue to resort to their traditional belief to give explanations to, you know, why people continue to suffer from sickness and disease, and so I think the mindset has not changed very much, and therefore I think people continue to blame people or accuse people.
PNG's traditional society has undergone rapid change in the last several decades. Ruth Kissam says this transition has caused great upheaval for many Papua New Guineans who, in an effort to negotiate this, sometimes subvert cultural norms.
You know, right now I'm going up to Wabeg on a case that we're trying to prosecute someone that actually ordered the torture of his own mom because he felt ashamed of being an educated person that everyone kept saying that his mother was a witch. You know, these kind of things are happening even to educated people. So it's a phenomenon that even I cannot be able to explain right now, but it's all probably due to the fact that the transition is in a very short space of time.
She says development, especially access to education and health, is pivotal to changing people's mindsets. But with national and provincial governments strapped for cash, no one's holding their breath. This is Johnny Blades.
The head of Transparency Solomon Islands says a court's decision to affirm tax-free salaries for MPs is a big step back for the country's transparency efforts. Last Friday, the Court of Appeal overturned a High Court ruling that declared the decision made last year by the Parliamentary Entitlements Committee, which has MPs sitting on it, was unconstitutional. In its judgment, the Court of Appeal said that while unpopular, the committee's decision was legal. The executive officer of Transparency, Ruth Lakwala, told Jamie Tahanaha the decision is extremely disappointing.
It is very disappointing, but not surprising to get the decision because just listening to the exchanges and all that, what we can hear and also what our lawyers could get from the way that the Court of Appeal was conducted, the questions being asked, is that yes, the decisions of the Parliamentary Entitlement Commission on awards that they give may be unpopular, very unpopular with the public and with people, but they are not illegal. They have the power.
Do you accept this judgment, or are you going to look at another avenue for appeal?
I think the appeal process is now done. But that doesn't mean to say that we couldn't do something more about it. Just because the Court of Appeal ruled that everything that was declared unconstitutional and weighed by the High Court is now constitutional, it does not make it right in my books. It doesn't make it right for any sensible person to look at it, because it is not right for members of parliament to influence the decisions, because they are in this commission as well, to award themselves such exorbitant awards and also tax-free salaries. Yes, there is a window of opportunity to do something about this and to change the law, because now we know that we need to change the law. But then we also know that the MPs are the ones that should change the law, but they are also the ones that, who will receive the entitlements.
So that gives little prospect for change.
Yeah, it is unlikely. And also of more concern is that the Court of Appeals decision has kind of validated the culture of MPs helping themselves to public funds without any scrutiny. It is just money that's going through them in a most untransparent way, and they don't account for it. And this is the biggest concern that I have. And more and more, we're seeing that Court of Appeal is perpetuating the kind of culture that we have in here that are being practiced by our leaders, which we think is not befitting for the office.
High tides that roll over sea walls and flooded houses in the Marshall Islands are unusual for this time of year. Peking tide periods in the Marshall Islands are generally from late January to late February. But our correspondent, Giff Johnson, says more out-of-the-season floods have been occurring since 2013. He told Daniela Marotta-Cox the weather station predicted some diminution over the weekend, but a storm on Tuesday worsened the situation.
We had pretty significant gusting winds blowing up from the south, and combined with the high tide, Egypt Island, which faces south, they got hit with tides. I mean, not much damage, but just the island was inundated, seawall damage, things like that. And then other houses along other islands facing that that south wind, the high tide just rolled into people's backyards and over seawalls and damaged whatever structures are built right by the lagoon.
Were people able to prepare for it?
It's hard to prepare for these things because most houses are built so close to the lagoon or the ocean, and there just isn't much space. So generally, a lot of people have seawalls, but in the case of inundations, we've seen the last couple of years, the water often just, you know, washes right up over. And it just depends. If the high tides are combined with a storm like we had yesterday, that's when we see more damage, because it just gets these storm surges pushing the already high level of water right up onto the islands.
How far in did the water reach?
Well, on Egypt, I was talking to one of the residents there, and he took a picture of a guy standing in the middle of the island, so it's probably close to 100 meters in. Fortunately, he said not too many houses were flooded, but it was just mostly water damage, and of course, that plays out with damaging trees, coconut trees, pandanus trees, which are food crops here, and that's a long-term issue which begins to show up a few weeks after the inundation happens.
So is there anything that can be done to mitigate those effects?
It's hard to say. I suppose more shoreline revetment, shoreline protection things, the existing seawalls can be improved. I mean, a big part of the challenge is that people, because of the demand for housing in Majuro, the capital, and on Ibai, the other main urban center at Kwajalein, is people have essentially built on every available piece of land up in the downtown area of Majuro. And like if you go back, you know, 60, 70 years, almost nobody lived in this area. They lived in the other end of the atoll, which was more stable. But, you know, it's how urbanization and development goes. So many people have built out of necessity on rather precarious pieces of property that are prone to flooding. So, yeah, it's a real challenge on a low-lying atoll to work out good shoreline protection from these events.
The controversial Sustainable Fisheries Partnership Agreement between the European Union and the Cook Islands has formally been adopted. Under the partnership, the Cook Islands will receive nearly $7 million U.S. dollars over a four-year period in return for providing access to four European flag purse sign fishing vessels, which will target the migratory shipjack tuna. The agreement includes a protocol to fish up to 7,000 tons per annum, around 156 fishing days, or 12% of the Cook Islands' 1,250 fishing day quota. The Secretary of the Marine Resources, Ben Ponia, told Don Wiseman what happens next.
Obviously, the agreement comes into force, being an agreement on principle between the Cook Islands and the European Union that will have effect for 8 years, and a protocol for access, which runs for a term of 4 years. So the next steps will be to engage on that protocol. And we already know from our negotiations that the European Union are intending to see access for four fishing vessels into our waters over this period.
So when do you think these ships will arrive?
Well, that's also a matter of the licensing procedures that we have to go through, the vetting and the checks. But assuming that we can move ahead quickly, I could see this as a matter of months, perhaps.
To what degree is there going to be servicing and interaction with crews and so on within the Cook Islands?
The Persein fleet, and these vessels will be part of that Persein fleet that operates in our waters, have very little interaction per se directly with any land-based operation. They fish at least 50 kilometres offshore. They tend to do the majority of their offloading and refueling and logistics from ports nearby in American Samoa, for example. And the next step to this whole fishery development is to, of course, get more onshore opportunities for developing those economic activities.
So you are actively looking at cannery possibilities and this sort of thing?
No, I wouldn't say we're actively looking at cannery possibilities. I think as a first step, there is an opportunity for some logistical support and having product being transshipped through our ports, maintenance, net cleaning, reprovisioning of food, crew being exchanged and so forth. But a cannery is highly unlikely for the Cook Islands with its limited population base and high cost of investment.
Now, this scheme has been highly controversial. There's been a lot of criticism locally. Fences have to be mended, don't they? So is any effort going to go into that?
Yeah, I think we have to continue our engagement with the community. I think to a certain degree there's been a lot of misinformation that's been propagated about this arrangement, and you know, in time the facts will reveal themselves as to what the real situation is. But this is an agreement and it's about developing long-term opportunities for Cook Islands, utilization of our large ocean economic exclusive zone, additional economic diversification of our economy, development of our northern Cook Islands, which are remote and largely being exempt from a lot of the opportunities that tourism may offer down south. And in fact, it will also be a manner in which we can divert revenue streams and interests into supporting our local fishermen, whom will be able to benefit from this arrangement.
What's the impact on the marine reserve?
If you're talking about our intentions to develop Marae Moana, which is basically our easy as a managed zone, so a zone where we're going to apply principles, high levels of commitments to conservation. It's not necessarily an approach where we will ban or commercial fishing, or mining and whatnot. There's no inconsistency here. We feel that as we are already doing, we can move our fishery in our zone to achieving high levels of adherence to conservation principles. We're not a country that's interested to simply take as much of the resource as possible. We're a small population. We can leave a fairly small footprint behind us.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A major national broadband transmission network is planned for Papua New Guinea. It'll be built by the Chinese technology firm Huawei, which is set to significantly increase the country's connectivity. But there are hopes that PNG is being cautious with the level of expenditure and borrowing that is needed for the arrangement. Paul Barker is from the Department of National Affairs, and he told Johnny Blade it's going to be rather interesting.
We're still largely dependent upon a very old, almost at capacity fibre optic cable to Australia and the new, not heavily used fibre optic cable out of Guam, which has now been connected to the north coast and through to the highlands, finally. So it's working its way through PNG. Now, this new proposal would link up with a connection proposed through to Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and across the Pacific, and as well as really building up that domestic infrastructure, as it were, for wholesale delivery of internet access, which then can be redistributed by the different service providers. So that's the sort of the background. And obviously, the government's core company that was only set up early in the year, PNG Data Co., which is partly evolved out of little offshoots of telecom and so on, it's the provider of this sort of backbone service, and it's come in with this partnership or contractual arrangement with Huawei, yep, who, of course, is a massive provider of telecommunications services.
Huawei say that the new network will connect via Jayapura in Indonesian territory as well. Is that a good thing?
Well, for sure. I mean, the more interconnections that PNG can be linked up with, frankly, the better. I mean, obviously, yes, there are some concerns that, yes, you've got a Chinese state-owned corporation running this, and we know that the United States has restricted Huawei from some of their major internet provision, but other countries, including the UK and others in Europe, have accepted them as a highly competitive, price competitive and technically proficient corporation, and have been happy to open the doors up to them. So I don't think PNG certainly may have concerns if they had an exclusive control, but certainly PNG would be missing out on the opportunities that they're able to provide if it imposed undue restrictions.
Can the government afford this at this time? I mean, mind you, it is something which obviously an important investment in the country's own growth and future anyway, so it would seem to be sensible, but can it afford it at this time?
Well, that's a good question. It's obviously to some extent dependent on the way the whole thing's structured as a commercial borrowing. Clearly, the recent tie-in through to the highlands and through to the network that Exxon has established, and Exxon and partners established from the highlands down to Moresby, and the expansion by Dataco from the Guam through from Lae, linking using some of the towers that the PNG Power has to link through to the highlands. That's helped increase capacity when that's fully functional through to the Guam fiber optic cable, which, as I say, is only about a fraction of its capacity is in use. So, yes, the importance of the connection to these Solomons and Fiji fiber optic cable, maybe that's not so critical. But, we should be cautious at the level of expenditure and the level of borrowing that is entailed.
An academic specializing in West Papua says Pacific Island peoples are taking the lead on issues of decolonization within the region. Dr. Kamia Webb-Gannon is a research fellow at the Western Sydney University School of Humanities and Communication Arts. She says the unprecedented level of discussion about West Papuan self-determination and human rights at the recent UN General Assembly reflects the new momentum towards the decolonization in the Pacific. Dr. Webb-Gannon spoke to Johnny Blades about the growth of the international solidarity for West Papua and the issue of regional representation.
as West Papuans have been able to get their stories out from, and I've been observing this, the conflict and the movement for about 10 years, I'd say it's from 2010 when this has really taken off. And then in 2011, I think Indonesia was picking up on the increased traction of West Papua in the international media. And so I think that's when Indonesia decided it really needed to start to have more influence in Melanesian and Pacific politics. And it was in 2011 that Indonesia was given observer status at the Melanesian Spearhead Group and really started heavy diplomacy into Melanesia to try and counteract the solidarity and the civil society support for West Papua.
Do you see any signs in Indonesia's kind of response that it will do anything other than just sort of push through its viewpoint?
Not in the near future, I don't. It seems you've heard also the Indonesia's first right of reply, no doubt, at the United Nations about a month ago, and it was quite uninformed, very typical Indonesian government response, saying that essentially there are very few, if any, human rights violations that have taken place in West Papua and that it would be impossible for them to go unscrutinised. And that's just blatantly untrue. And then you have several Indonesian NGOs going, that's ludicrous. And, you know, that's typically what the response has been. It doesn't look like it's changing, but it does look like Indonesia's getting more worried. Therefore, they're increasing their diplomatic efforts.
There is this argument about regional representation for the Papuans, and do you think that the Pacific support can be effective? You know, can it overcome the geopolitical forces?
Well, I think it already is. I mean, the fact that for the first time West Papua has been raised at the UN by seven countries, not just Melanesian countries, but from Tonga and Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands and Nauru and Palau as well, is a huge testament to the work that the United Liberation Movement for West Papua has been undertaking. So a whole lot of diplomacy by the leaders of the ULMWP around the Pacific, but also this taps into the Pacific Renaissance, which I think has, you know, been sweeping across the Pacific for the past 5 or 6 years. So I guess for the first time since around the 1970s, 80s, when the Pacific was starting to decolonize, it's a new spirit of decolonization. I think it's more strident than it's ever been before, and it's more powerful. And these Pacific countries are making very good use of regional fora and international fora, and West Papua is one of the top issues. I think that the Pacific is really taking the lead on this.
The former Samoan football chief executive, Sari Baraman, believes she can make major changes to the women's game. The former Samoan women's international, Baraman, was appointed last week at FIFA's first ever chief women's football officer. She will lead a newly created women's football division and told Barry Guy there's much that she wants to achieve.
Having come through women's football from a member country, being Samoa, into a confederation, Oceania, I've had a large involvement in women's football there. And what I've enjoyed about Oceania is the fact that the impact I can have is much wider in the countries within the Pacific. So I guess what appeals the most for me about the position in FIFA is that it then becomes an ability to make a global impact in such an important area. So it's very exciting.
Is it because of some personal experiences within the region that, you know, you'd like to make a difference?
Absolutely, yes. And I think what I've experienced in the Pacific region is not unique. Something that I've come to learn since my involvement in football is that the challenges that we face as women within football are the same all the world over. Even the most developed countries in the world, the challenges are similar. So whilst my experience has been in the Pacific region primarily, what I know now is that these problems and these challenges that we face are worldwide.
I'm sure there are many things that you want to overcome, but what would you like to achieve?
For me, women's football within FIFA represents the biggest growth opportunity. At the moment, it really is an untapped resource in terms of commercialisation of women's football. I think even in terms of participation of players, part of the role which is quite dear to my heart is the use of football as a tool to assist with women's empowerment and gender equality. There are many countries in the world where women are not in good positions because of their gender. And I've seen through my work that football as a sport really does have a unique power to overcome some of these barriers.
So your new position, do you have the power to achieve what you want? You can make change?
Yes, absolutely. The role is quite a powerful role within the world of football. There's some very, very good people working within women's football at the moment, all around the world, not just within FIFA. And my aim really is to take as much from these people and get their support and also have their input. The thing that really excites me is that it really is a position that can influence change and can lead change. And for me, this is one of the greatest aspects of the role.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can catch a 3-time daily edition of this program on PCJ Radio International through our FM and shortwave partners in the Pacific region. You can also use the same email address to contact us for the information on times and frequencies. So on behalf of everyone else here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah.